Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. And I know still in California, it's Rhyme Tovim, I believe. It's only 5:30. But it's already dark. It's Poshkia. Anyways, we want to welcome back Rabbi Yitzchak Et Shalom for our shiur tonight. Rabbi Et Shalom has been teaching Torah in California since 1985. He is the Brush Beit Midrash at Shalhevet. He runs the Beit Midrash program at ULIS Girls. It's a YULA school for girls. He teaches widely. He is working on a book for on Amos that will soon be published by Koren. And his series, Between the Lines of the Bible, is a methodological guide for the studying of Tanakh. And it's really one of the experts in Tanakh. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Et Shalom. Bakasha.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. It's great to be here. I take it you can all hear me. I'm muted. Great. Okay. And I tell you, it was a real fortuitous. I was emailing Rabbi Kelman about one of the many things that we have in common a few weeks ago, and then he sent me a note saying, "Would you give the Parsha Shir for Parshat Vayera?" And it was an easy choice to say yes, because Parshat Vayera is so chock full of great stuff to talk about. I mean, we could certainly spend an entire shiur on four words at the beginning of the parasha, which is Vahotzeiti, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Velakachti. But since Parshat Vayera is a majority of the story of what we call the plagues, and I'll explain why I'm saying what we call the plagues, therefore I figured we would take a sort of grand look, a broad look at the whole system of the plagues of Makot Mitzrayim, and try to figure out what's going on. And I'm going to start with a basic question before we get started, which is the plagues. If you think about it, when we think about the plagues as Dam, Tzfardea, Kinim, etc., are an absolutely unnecessary enterprise, because if it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's interest to punish Egypt, hit them once, hit them hard. If it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interest to get Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim, there's a very simple solution, which is put the Egyptians to sleep for an hour or one night. Tell Moshe Rabbeinu the Egyptians will not wake up. The guards will be asleep. Get Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim. They'll wake up in the morning and we'll be gone, and that'll be it. There's a lot of simple ways to do it. The Makot seems to be a deliberately drawn out, extended process, which seems to be gratuitous, and it seems to be unnecessary. So we have to explore what is going on with the Makot. Now, if you ask the average person on the street, or I'm actually going to do this in memory of the dear departed Alex Trebek, Olam Hashalom, if you ask, and I know even in Canada he's known, if you're on Jeopardy and you say, "Alex, I'll take Pesach for $200 or Exodus for $200. And he says, "This is the amount of plagues with which God smote the Egyptians." You would say, "Alex, what is 10? And you'd get the $200. The question is whether 10 really is the number. Now, the reason I say that is because we've all grown up with Esther Makot. We've grown up with putting our hands in the wine and dipping it out. We've put in, some of us even have a song for it. Believe it or not, we even have a dance at our Seder to the Esther Makot. So we all know the Esther Makot. The question is, who says there's 10 Makot? Now, it's funny because we have a whole bunch of different things in the Torah that we say there are a group of. Abraham had 10 tests. There are 10 dibrot, right? 10 makot. We'll take those three. Well, the truth is that if you look through the Torah, you can't find 10 things that happened to Abraham that are explicitly called tests. You can't. You can find one that might be called a test. That's the Akedah. Maybe it's a test. Maybe it's not. It's a machloket. But Chazal have a tradition of 10 nisyonot. On the other extreme of that is the Aseret HaDibrot. Because even though when you look at the Decalogue, you can discern about 15 mitzvot, so 10 commandments is a bad translation, and you can possibly discern 11 or 9 separate statements, nonetheless, the Torah itself refers to that experience as Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 utterances. So Aseret HaDibrot is a legitimate representation of what the Torah says. Makot sits somewhere in the middle, because there are numerous times that HaKadosh Baruch Hu attacks the Egyptians, and some of those times the verb used is vayach, he smote, he hit, But how do we get 10 makot? So if you take a look at it in source one right in front of you, or if you printed out the pages, you could see that in the famous fifth parak of Pirkei Avot, of Mishnah Avot, which is the numbers parak. It says there's 10 of these, 10 of these, 10 of these, 7 of these, 7 of these, 5 of these, 4 of these, etc. Among the tens, it says there were 10 miracles that happened to us in Mitzrayim and 10 on the sea. Of course, that's not explicit in the Torah. Eser makot tevia kadosh baruch hu l'mitzrayim b'mitzrayim, and by the way, v'asara al hayam. So 10 plagues with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu smote the Egyptians in Egypt, and another 10 at the sea. Now that's, of course, not explicit at all in the Torah. And then there's about the 10 tests with which we tested God. So we see that the Eser Makot is a rabbinic idea that shows up in the Mishnah. However, it's not so simple, because as you are, I'm sure, familiar, there are numerous other recountings of the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim in Tanakh. And one of them is Psalm 78. Psalm 78, which is a very long psalm, recounts the major parts of Am Yisrael's history. It actually ends with a rejection of Shiloh as the place of the Mikdash and a selection of Yehudah. And in that, it tells the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Please take a look at it in front of you in source two. And to make life easy, I highlighted the makot. Which makot are listed here? Dam, then Arov, the mixed swarm, whatever that is. Sfardea, which by the way means we're already out of order. Chasil is another word for Arbe, the locusts. Barad, so again, we're out of order. So if I was to do them by numbers, it would be 1, 4, 2, 8, 7, then Dever, which is number 5, and then Bechor, which is number 10. Notice, by the way, the three of the Makot, what we call Makot, aren't even listed here, all right? Which, by the way, which three are not listed here? It's going to become significant later on. Kinim, Shechin, and Choshech. Those are not listened to. All right, so that means when we look at it, if you were to ask the author of Psalm 78, how many makot were there? His answer may be there were 7 makot. The Torah never says 10 makot. And yet we have a strong tradition of 10 makot. Let's see where that tradition comes from, and let's see what these makot are about. Now, what you're looking at in source 3, which is translated below, is 4 verses from the book of Deuteronomy. And these 4 verses, these 4 psukim, come from something that has nothing to do with Pesach. It comes from a mitzvah, which we call mitzvat mikra bikurim. When a farmer would bring his fruit sometime in the summer, after Shavuot, ideally before Sukkot, to Yerushalayim and offer them to the Kohen, he would make a declaration. In most circumstances, if he owned the land, and et cetera, he would make a declaration. And the declaration starts with these words right here. They may look familiar. Arami Oved Avi. My father was a wandering Aramean. He went down to Egypt. He was there with a small group. He became a great, big, and powerful nation there, etc. Good. And these 4 psukim from the middle of Pasuk Hei, all of Vav, all of Zayin, all of Chet, comprise the core of the Haggadah. The Mishnah in Psachim tells us that after the son asks questions of the father teaches the son and explains the story from here. Arami Oved Avi Ad Shegomer Kol HaParsha. And by the way, if you want to really sum it up and really have a very quick Seder, you can't get away with this. But if you really want to sum it up, you look at these 4 Pasukim, and each Pasuk essentially expresses a single idea. The first Pasuk expresses the idea of exile. We went down to Egypt. We left Israel. The second verse, the second pasuk, represents the idea of servitude and oppression. Avodah. The third represents tefillah, that we cried out to God to save us. And the fourth is God saved us. And a very easy way to remember it in Hebrew, it's a rhyme, is galut avdut tefillah geulah. Exile, oppression, prayer, and redemption. But I want to focus our attention on the last pasuk, because if you recall from Corona Seder number 1, and God willing, we won't have Corona Seder number 2, but if you remember from Pesach 2020, from the Haggadah, we take each one of these phrases and we have a midrash. Our Ami Oved Avi teaches that Lavan tried to destroy, was worse than Paro, tried to destroy Yaakov. Vayered Mitzrayim Anus al Pi Adibur. Vayagor Sham Lamed She Lo Yarad Lishtakel Lagur, etc. In the last pasuk, we have drashot. We'll look at them. Vayotzienu Adonai Mitzrayim. God took us out Biyad Chazaka Uvizroa Netuya. Parenthetically, my friend Professor Josh Berman from Bar Ilan has a marvelous, marvelous take on that phrase, and that explanation alone is worth the price of his book Ani Ma'amin. But the book is an amazing book, and I highly recommend it. And in it, he talks about this phrase and what the significance of it is in the light of Egyptology. God took us out with a strong hand and an outstretched arm and great fear and signs and wonders. Okay, what does that mean? So let's take a look at the Sifri, a very curious comment. So a little bit of an introduction. When we talk about the literature of the Chachamim, the literature of the sages, and I mean specifically during the period of the Mishnah, we think of one piece of literature which is the core of Jewish law, and that is the Mishnah. The Mishnah was taught orally, it was committed to memory, it was passed on orally. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah was not written down probably until the 6th or 7th century. And so for all those hundreds of years, it was transmitted orally. And the form of the Mishnah, I'm sure everybody here has studied a Mishnah before, the form of the Mishnah is just, here's the law. No psukim, no discussions, here's the law. But there is yet another kind of teaching that the Chachamim were engaged in, which is called Midrash. And Midrash means that they would take a look at the words of the Torah, and they would interpret the words of the Torah and come out with a halakha as a result. It's called Midrash Halakha, or really Midrash Tanaim. And each book of the Torah that has halakha in it has an accompanying Midrash. So the single most important one of them is the book of Vayikra, and its Midrash is called the book. The book. And how do you say the book in Aramaic? Sifra. Sifra, the book, HaSefer. We also call it Torat Kohanim. The Midrash on Shmot is called the Mechilta. And the Midrash on Bamidbar and Dvarim is called Sifrei, the other books. So the Sifrei on Dvarim, on our Pasuk, has the following comment. I don't know, somehow somebody scribbled on the source sheets here. So if it's possible to erase it, that would be helpful.
That's from you. The only person who can write is the host. So I don't exactly know, but hopefully we can ignore that. You'll get to this. I don't know how to erase it exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, luckily it's a light color. Okay. Vayered Mitzrayma. Now take a look at this and tell me if this doesn't look familiar. Source 4. Melamed shelo yarad yishtakea lalagur sham. So you see on the pasuk that says he went down to Egypt, the Midrash says, this teaches that he did not go to settle down, but rather to travel around. Shema tomar shirad lito keter malchut. You think he went there to become a king? Tamud lomar vayagor sham. He went there to visit. Yachol b'uchlusim harbei. I might think he went down with a big population. So does this sound like our Haggadah? Not really. A little bit, but not really. Tamud lomar bimtei ma'at. He went down with a small group. Kinyan she'emar b'shivim nefesh yardu avotecha Mitzrayimah. That your ancestors went down with 70 people. Now it says, Vahi sham legoy gadol in the pasuk. The parts that are pasuk I underlined. Melamecho Yisrael mitzuyanim sham. It shows that Am Yisrael was actually distinct and distinguished there. They were a separate nation. Now notice, they've skipped psukim, they've skipped phrases. One, like jumping from around. God saw our affliction. Interesting, they quote the pasuk about killing the babies at birth. We saw our pain. And then look what's next. And I want you to look at this phrase here. That means etc. So in other words, this Sifrei from the 3rd century quotes something and then says, etc., as if there's some other text out there that we all know that we don't have to waste time putting in here because we all know it, etc. And what's the end of that text? Rabbi Yehuda hayan otein behem siman detzach adash be'achav. Does that sound familiar? That's the end of that midrash that says biyad chazakah v'zruah netuyah, etc. Rabbi Yehuda had his mnemonic. We're going to get back to the mnemonic because it's a key to what we're doing tonight. Detzach adash be'achav. Okay. We're going to look into this further. I want to show you two more texts, one purely for fun. But my students are always reminding me that my sense of fun is not exactly the same as theirs. So while I find this fun, you hopefully will also. What you're looking at in source 5 is a Ktav Yad. It is a manuscript from, I believe, the 11th century, maybe the 10th. And it is, by the way, from the Vatican Library. You can access it online. Anybody's interested, I could send you the link. And it is the best manuscript of the Sifrei. And it's happens to be Vatican number 32, as you can see. And here you can see Vayar et onyenu chule Rabbi Yehuda haya noten behem simanin raditzach adash be'achav. And then it goes on. So I just thought you'd be interested in seeing the manuscript. Okay. But in a later work, which is an expansion on that, which was publicized by Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman at the end of the 19th century, called Midrash Tanaim, it gets big. Now, by the way, Rav David Zvi Hoffman did not use this font and he did not use these colors. Well, I did that. So here we go. Vayotzienu Adonai Mimitzrayim, God took us out of Egypt. Lo al yidei malach. Does this start sound familiar? Velo al yidei saraf, velo al yidei shaliach, el HaKadosh Baruch Hu biatzmo. Not with an angel, not with a seraph, not with a messenger, but God himself took us out. Biyad chazakah zehadever. That refers to the cattle plague. And they quote a pasuk, Moshe Neemar, Hine yad Adonai huyab miknecha. God's hand is going to affect your cattle, and that's the cattle plague. Uvizroa netuyad, outstretched arm, zoha cherev. That refers to the sword. Which sword? Well, you could spend an hour at the Seder talking about that one. Quote a pasuk from Divrei Yamim about the plague of Jerusalem. Uvamora gadol, great fear, zegilui shchina. That's the appearance of God's presence. And here, they quote a pasuk. We're going to look in a minute in our Haggadah. We'll see it's not the same pasuk. V'yar Yisrael de'yad ha'gdola. Uv'otot zehamateh. Otot refers to the staff of Moshe. And he quote a pasuk. Uv'moftim. Now, by the way, you noticed the green shaded text are our text. And the yellow texts are other texts from elsewhere used to support them. Elu hamakot, and they quote the pasuk from Yoel. Davar acher. Here we go. Remember we said, where do we get 10 makot from? You look in the Torah and you count. You're not so sure that you can count 10 makot. You can maybe count more than 10 makot. Maybe you can count less than 10 makot. And the Torah never says 10 makot. So where did 10 makot come? And remember, when you looked in Psalms, we got 7 makot. Where did it come from? Davar acher. Biyad chazaka, shtayim. Izroa netuya, shtayim. Mora gadol, shtayim. Votot shtayim uv moftim shtayim. Basically, the Midrash does math. Think about this. Biyad chazaka is two words. That's two plagues. God took us out with a strong hand. Two words. Izroa netuya, an outstretched arm. That's another two words. Moragadol, another two words. Otot and moftim are both in the plural. Minimum plural is two. Two plus two plus two plus two plus two equals 10. Elu eser makot shevi'a kodesh baruch hu al mitzrim b'mitzrayim. And notice the Midrash does not list them. It just says those are the 10 makot. And by the way, this is not necessarily something that everybody agreed that there were 10 makot. But the Midrash is making the argument. We're going to argue there were 10 based on this pasuk. And then they point out that Rabbi Yehuda haya noten behem siman detzach adash be'achav. And that same mnemonic of the 10 letters with the three words, detzach adash be'achav, is a way to remember it. Okay. Now, our last thing we're going to do before we're going to get into Parshat Vayera, and I know that's a long introduction, but it's a necessary one, is I want you to take a look here at our Haggadah, that passage in our Haggadah. It's right in front of you. On the right side, I put the Rambam's version of it, which is slightly different. And on the left side, I put the classic Ashkenazi Haggadah. And we're going to look at this. Take a look at it. Vayotzienu Adonai Mitzrayim. The underlined sections are our Pasuk. God took us out of Egypt, not with an angel, not with a seraph, etc. And it has a midrash inside the midrash. You may remember this from Pesach. Only God took us out of Mitzrayim, Shenemar, and we have the Pasuk, Vavarti, Veretz Mitzrayim, Balai, Lahazeb. And then each of those phrases is there to exclude some other agent. And then Biyad Chazaka is the cattle plague, Mizron Tuya is the sword, Moragadol is Gilui Shechina, right? And then Otot and Moftim, and then here we go, Davar Acher, Biyad Chazaka Shtayim, Mizron Tuya Shtayim, Moragadol Shtayim. And now what do we see for the first time? Elu Eser Makot Shem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzvim V'Mitzrayim Ve'Elu Hein, and for the first time we see an actual list. This is the list, the canonical list that we all know. This is the first place it shows up in our Haggadah. Dam, Tzfardea, Kinim, Arov, Dever, Shechin, Barad, Arbech, Choshech, Makat, Bechorot. And Rabbi Yehuda would give it Simanim, which is Tetzach, Adash, Be'achav. One note about Rabbi Yehuda and his mnemonic. This is not the only place that Rabbi Yehuda uses a mnemonic. What's the value of a mnemonic? A mnemonic, which is a memory device, is there so that you can remember something. We all use mnemonics all the time. We all use little triggers in our head to be able to remember information. If somebody's phone number is 9009, so remember, oh, it's nines and zeros, and the zeros are in the middle. We have ways of remembering it. Sometimes we will turn the numbers into a word. We'll say, oh, his phone number is Jabber Person, right? And you dial the first seven numbers of that, and you get it. Now, Rabbi Yehuda, as you see in the Mishnah and Menachot, also had a siman for something totally different, which is how big the size of the showbread, the lechem apanim. If you don't mean shalotite zadad yahez, right? That it's seven etzbaot by four sides, etc. So Rabbi Yehuda was comfortable using these sort of mnemonic devices. All right. All of that is an introduction, because what we really need to do is take a look at the Makot and see what's going on. And again, I want to address our original question, which is, why Makot? Why not just kill all the Egyptians, take Bnei Israel out? Or why not get the Egyptians involved in a war in the Sudan, and while they're busy, Israel can leave? Or put the Egyptians to sleep for a week? There's a lot of ways they can get us out without having to go through the Makot. Why the Makot? So let's take a look. We're going to do a quick run-through of those 10 Makot. The truth is we're not going to, because I'm going to say something here that'll sound a little bizarre. We started this year by asking how many Makot. And I showed you that in Tehillim Ayin Chet, there's 7 Makot. If you'd ask me how many Makot there are, I'm going to give a very unconventional answer. But of course, you didn't come to Torah in Motion to hear conventional answers. And the answer I'm going to give you is, how many Makot were there? There's one Makah. One Makah. And what Makah is that? So if you look back here, think about how we say the Makot, Dam, Tzfardea, Kini, Marov, Dever, Shechin, Barad, Arbech, Choshech, and then Makat Bechorot. The only one that's called a Makah in our lingo is Bechorot, right? But you're going to see why that's the case. At the very beginning of the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is last week in Parshat Shmot, the very first thing that Moshe is supposed to say to this new Paro, who was Moshe's adopted grandfather or father or whatever, had already died. The one who put out a contract on Moshe had already died. And now Moshe comes back and there's a new Paro and Moshe's negotiating with him. The first thing he says to him, or that he's told to say to him, is right here in front of you in Source 10. V'amarta el Paro. God says, go tell Paro, Ko Amar Adonai B'ni V'chori Yisrael. Go tell Paro, Hashem says, Am Yisrael is my firstborn son. Va'omar Elecha. And Paro said, and Paro, I'm telling you, Shalach et B'ni V'ya'avdeni. Send my son forth that he can serve me. Not you, but me. Vatma'en l'shalchon, you refuse to let him go. Hine anochi horeg et bincha b'chorecha. By the way, this is before any of it starts. Before any of the negotiations start. Moshe is told to come and tell Paro about makat b'chorot. You don't let my firstborn, Am Yisrael, go. I'm going to kill your firstborn son. So makat b'chorot is already in the cards. Okay. Now let's see what happens. And we're going to discover a curious structure to the makot. And we're going to discover new meaning to Rabbi Yehuda's mnemonic. And then we'll be able to, God willing, by 9:28, answer the question of why makot at all? What's the purpose? Okay, let's start from the beginning. We're going to run through them. Here they are. Here's number one, dumb. And fortunately, we had exactly 10 sources, so just ignore the one. Source 11 is source one, right? Dumb. Notice how dumb happens. Not how the plague happens, but how the interaction happens. I'll translate everything. God says to Moshe, Paro is stubborn. He's not going to let him go. Lech el Paro baboker. Go to Paro in the morning. Hine yotze hamayma. And like the Rishonim point out, it was Paro's custom to go and walk by the Nile in the morning to see how the waters of the Nile were doing. They, of course, worshiped the Nile and believed the Nile to be some sort of a demigod. And so this is Paro with his advisors and his counselors and his wizards are all around him. It's a big public spectacle. You stand there on the bank of the Nile facing him, face up to him. Take that staff, the one that you used in his palace to turn into a serpent, into a snake, take it in your hand. This is what I want you to say to him. Adonai Elohei Avrim Shlachani Elecha Lemor. The God of the Hebrews has sent me to tell you, Shalach et ami v'avduni b'amidbar. All right, we know the message. Let my people go that they may serve me in the desert. You're still not listening. Ko amar Adonai. This is what God says. Bizot teda ki ani Adonai. With this, you will know that I am Hashem. Listen carefully to those words. Right, and we've highlighted them on purpose. I'm going to hit with the staff. I'm going to hit the water. The water is going to turn to blood, and the rest of this is a description of the blood. Okay, so that means that before the plague of blood happens, Moshe publicly faces off against Paro. Moshe warns Paro in front of everybody, and he says to him that this sign that you're about to see has a theological message to it, which is, I am Hashem. In other words, Hashem is a God to be reckoned with. Hashem is a real God, if you will, a real power. Okay, and of course, he does it, and Paro is stubborn, and it doesn't help. We go to Makkah number two. Now, based on what we just saw, what should happen before Makkah number two? We would expect Moshe to come in the morning and face Paro publicly and say, here's the message, and frauds. Curiously, that's not what happens. Number 12 is frauds. Vayomer Adonai Moshe, bo el paro. What does bo el paro mean? Come to Paro, which means come into his palace. This is going to be private. I want you to come into him, just walk in, and privately, here's what you're going to tell him. Let my people go, etc. If you don't let them go, hine anochi nogef et kol gvulcha batzfardim. If you don't let them go, I am going to attack your entire area with your entire border, entire territory with frogs. If that's what Tzfardim are, frogs, crocodiles, whatever they are. Okay. Now notice here, the warning was private. And you notice something else? There is no message to the warning. He doesn't say, when this happens, you're going to know the following. He just says, I'm warning you, you don't let them go, frogs. Okay, frogs doesn't work. So we go to the third thing. Watch what happens. Hashem says to Moshe, tell Aaron, hit the ground and bring out lice. There's no warning whatsoever. So if I'm a betting man and I'm reading through and I don't know what's coming next, which is, by the way we should always read Torah, that we don't know what's coming next, and allow us to be surprised and anticipate all the possibilities and see which one actually plays out, I would say Paro got fair warning up here with them. And from here on in, anything else that's going to happen is going to be without warning, boom, 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 until Paro finally caves in. And I am surprised because I go now to Makan number 4, which is Arov, and it's kind of like we're back to the beginning. Vayomer Adonai Moshe Hashkem baboker v'yatzei lifnei Paro, get up in the morning, stand up in front of Paro, hinei yotzei amaymai, out of the water, again publicly, and give him the message, and if you don't let them go, then I'm going to hit you with Arov. And why am I going to hit you with Arov? Whatever Arov is, mixed swarm of insects or mixed swarm of animals. Laman teda ki ani Adonai b'kerav haaretz. So you will know that I am Hashem in the land. All right, we're going to come back to this. We're going to review this. All right. So now I'm a little surprised. For Dam, this happened. The public warning with a theological message. Sfardea, private warning, no message. Kinim, no warning. Then suddenly Arov, I'm back to the beginning. So I'm getting a sense that there's a rhythm here. So I'm not so surprised when Dever, number 5, happens as a private warning with no message. Come to Paro. Come into the palace. Right? And tell him, this is what Hashem says, let my people go, they will worship me. If you refuse to let them go, and are you still holding on to them? I'm going to hit you with a plague that affects the animals, affects the mammals. All right. By the way, notice that the mammals that are mentioned here chiefly are horses, Egyptian army, think about the army. Camels, think about the merchants, the trade in Egypt, because camels are used for long distance hauling. And bakar, cattle. Why are cattle so important in Egypt, parenthetically? Because Egypt was chiefly a farming country. And as a result of that, cattle were critical because they were used for plowing. Think about Paro's dreams. Paro's dreams are about cattle, Paro, back way back in Yosef's time, cattle and stocks, because Egypt is basically an agronomic society, right? Good. Okay. And I'm going to hit them with Dever Kaved Meod. And there's really fun plays on words here of Dever and Davar in the text. And now what happens to the next one? Paro doesn't cave in. Paro hardens his heart at Dever. And so now, Hashem says to Moshe and Aharon, take your hands full of soot from the oven, from an oast, from a kiln. Go in front of Paro and just throw it up in the air. No warning at all. And it's going to become dust over all of Mitzrayim. It will become boils on the people and on the animals. Okay. Paro again is stubborn. And it's not like we go back to the beginning, back to the water, back to the public standoff. Get up in the morning, stand in front of Paro. This is what Hashem says. Let my people go there. When we worship me, this time I'm sending it all against you. It's all going to nail you. Again, a message that you will know that there is none like me in the land. We're going to come back to these messages. I hit you with Dever, and you're almost disappeared. But I kept you alive for one reason. This is like the fighter who keeps getting knocked out and the trainer keeps reviving him at number nine and keeps giving him strength to go back into the ring and take more punishment. I want you to see my power and I want you to tell my name throughout the land. Listen to that line because it's vital. You are still playing with my people. You're not letting them go. I'm going to hit you with very heavy hail. I don't know if you guys have ever been in a serious hailstorm. It is frightening and it is quite destructive. There's never been a hailstorm like this in Egypt since the day that Egypt came to be. Okay, and we all know what happens. Barad and Paro ignores, and Bnei Israel are still in Mitzrayim. So what's next? So we go to next week's Parsha. Vayomer Adonai Moshe Boel Paro. Parshat Bo. This is where it comes from. Come to Paro. I've kept him stubborn so that I can make, listen again to this idea. I've made him stubborn so that I can place these signs of mine in his presence. I want you to also tell your kids and your grandchildren what I did to Mitzrayim. I toyed with Mitzrayim. And the signs, my signs that I put among them, and you will know that I am Hashem. All right, and so Moshe and Aaron come to Paro, and they say, people go, and if not, then I'm going to hit you with Arbeh. Now, by the way, this is in the palace, and Arbeh is locusts. And then Hashem says to Moshe, after the locust doesn't work, Hashem says to Moshe, put your hands up and there'll be darkness on Mitzrayim and there's darkness for 3 days. And that's the plagues. We're familiar with them. But what's happening here? How come that we keep going back and forth between going to the water, going to the palace, no warning, what's going on? So we have to come back to our original question, which is why Makot? Why not just destroy Mitzrayim? Why not just get him involved in a war somewhere else? All the different things that I played with as possibilities, why the Makot? So what emerges very clearly from the text, as we've read it through, is that the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim is a story that has to have impact on two audiences in different ways. Similar, but different ways. First of all, Bnei Israel have got to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's might, his power, his concern for his children, and his hashgacha, his awareness of everything that's going on. And Bnei Israel have to see it and experience it, and then they have to tell it to their children and grandchildren, and that's, of course, Leila Seder and every day of our lives. But that's not all. It is clear from the text, we've seen some of them, and there's many more, that Paro has to publicly announce HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the God. Now, I want to be very clear here, because at no point in the text is there an expectation, a demand, or even a mention of Paro saying, Ein od milvado, of Paro saying there is no other God. We don't expect that. What we do want Paro to say is the God of Israel, the God of the Hebrews, Hashem Elohei Israel, has power over all of the gods of Egypt. That's what the message he has to get. And why is that such a critical message? Because when you look through, and here's where the haftarot are helpful. You look at the haftarah that we're going to read this week from Yechezkel. And Yechezkel has a rebuke against Egypt and against Paro, who says, Li ya'ori va'ani asitini. I am the Nile. I created the Nile. I am the creator of Egypt. The fact that the pharaohs considered themselves and were considered to be demigods and divinities is well documented. And that they believed that they had power and the power of the gods of Egypt and to protect Egypt and everything, well known. Now, there were revolutions in Egypt. And there was a monotheistic pharaoh who came along at one point. But for the most part, and the pharaohs we're dealing with, didn't have that belief. And so Moshe, like Avraham, has a mission to get the people who believe in all of these different pagan gods to avow publicly that Hashem has power. However, Moshe Rabbeinu is Moshe Rabbeinu because he's a master educator. Rabbeinu. You ask, what was he great at? He was great at a lot of things, but what's he known for? He's known as a teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu. And as a great teacher, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course, is a great educational supervisor. And as a great teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu sets upon this educational program of getting Paro around to seeing things as he should. Now, important to note, you cannot take somebody, and this animates so much of the Rambam's thinking, you cannot take somebody who has spent their entire life and in previous generations in their society, who has had a particular viewpoint, you can't get them in 1 second to drop it and shift to another viewpoint. You got to go slowly. You got to take your time and go slowly and move them from one place to another. So what's the first lesson? Let's think about it. How do you know how to teach students? So I'll tell you what I do. The first day of class, if I have new students, meaning normally when I teach class, I have students, many of them who I had the previous year, but at some point they were new. When I have new students, one of the first things I do is I give them a quiz. And I tell them the quiz does not count. The quiz is not for you, the quiz is for me. And I give them a quiz and I see how they've done and I say, oh, that's what they know. Or I'll engage them in conversation around the piece of Gemara we're going to study. And I see how much do they know? How well do they read? How much background information do they have? What are their skills like? Because if I'm going to be a good teacher, I've got to start where they're at. I can't walk into the room and say, this is my curriculum. I don't care what you know. That's not a teacher. That's a machine and a bad machine. I have to walk in and say, I don't know what they know. Let me find out. And I'll spend a few days getting to know them. Getting to know what they know, getting to know what their skills are, getting to know what their interests are. And then I craft the curriculum based on that. I'll be honest with you, this year for educators, all educators around the world, has been a year of reinventing the wheel over and over and over. And the good teachers are the ones who keep changing what they're doing, because we're just starting as if education never existed before, in a sense. With Zoom and hybrid teaching and everything else, it's a new ballgame. I have changed, in one of my classes, I have changed my curricular style with the students 14 times this semester. Because I try something, and I get feedback from them, and I see if it works, and I fix it, and I fine tune it, and I change it. So you've got to start out by saying, what do the students know? And then you got to work. And then if it doesn't work, you shift. Or you move it up a notch. Move to our next level and you want to keep them challenged. Okay, so let's go and take that educational philosophy, which is not a philosophy, it's education, it's pedagogy. And let's take a look at how Moshe applies it. Moshe's job is to teach Paro a lesson. And the lesson is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the powerful God in Egypt. But remember, the first time that Moshe came to Paro and introduced the idea of letting Hashem's people go, that they could worship him, his answer was, Mi Adonai Asher Shema B'Kolo. Lo Yadati Et Adonai. I don't know who this God is. So the first thing to do is got to introduce you. So what happens? The very first thing is he comes out publicly and he warns Paro and he says, I'm going to give you a lesson, and with that lesson you will know Ki Ani Hashem. You're going to know that Hashem exists. Hashem exists, because you don't think he exists. I'm going to show you that he exists. Okay. And that lesson basically is dumb. But after dumb, Paro is stubborn and he won't listen. So you know what Moshe said? Moshe comes into the palace and says, okay, listen, you're still not getting the lesson, so I'm going to hit you again with frogs. Paro still doesn't get it. Even though Paro, remember, at frogs said to Moshe, I'll let them go, but please pray that the frogs go away. And Moshe says, when? He says, tomorrow. Okay, now you'll know what Hashem is the God. And Moshe prays, and the frogs are gone, and Paro, forget about it. So what happens? This lesson isn't over. Boom, kinim. Okay. Well, Paro failed that semester. But as often happens in many of our schools, even though he failed that semester, he matriculated to the next grade anyways. And so Moshe comes in and says, Paro. He meets him publicly and he says, lesson number two. You already know that God exists. You won't admit it, but you know God exists. We hit you three times. You get it. Second lesson. God exists among the land. God isn't just some theoretical idea. God exists here in the land and he has power here in the land. So now, and by the way, notice, and now all the things that are going to happen are going to happen on the land level before they happen from underground. Now they're on the land. Swarms of either insects or animals. Paro says, okay, and then no, right? Stubborn. And then he comes in and he says to him, okay, I'm going to hit you again. I'm going to hit you again with Dever, with plague of the animals. And then finally, without any warning, Shechin. Okay, guess what? Paro washed out a semester too. But we put him into a graduate seminar and see if we can do any better with him. And he comes to him publicly and he says, Paro, I'm going to give you lesson number three. Because the reality is, Paro, I know that you know lesson number one, and I know that you learned lesson number two, and it's your silly pride that's getting in the way of you admitting it. So we're going to move on to lesson three, because I know you actually know them. You got an F, but inside you actually have an A. And so now the third lesson is, I'm going to hit you so that you will know that there is none like me in the land. Not just that I exist, not that I have power in the land. I am the most powerful God here. And again, at no point is there an expectation that Paro is going to say there is no other God. That's not going to happen. And so that's the final lesson. And that's as far as we want to get Paro to come. By the way, it works because we don't leave Mitzrayim until Paro comes in the middle of the night and wakes Moshe up and says, okay, leave. I know that Hashem is the powerful God. Go. And by the way, since Hashem is the powerful God and you're asking us to go, we're going to turn around and say, no, we're going to go when we're ready, like in the morning. Not now. Now we're in the driver's seat. And so here, the third lesson, there is none like me. Then privately comes in and says, listen, you're not getting it. I'm going to hit you with locusts. And then finally, Choshech. So essentially, if I were to ask you how many makot are there, I'd answer there's one. Because the one actual makah is makat b'chorot. But there's an educational program of three lessons. And each lesson starts out with a statement of the lesson. Just like you get in front of the class and say, today we're going to learn quadratic equations. Then we're going to have a drill. And then we're going to have a second drill. Then we're going to have a homework assignment. And then a pop quiz. That's what Moshe does. Rabbi Yehuda comes along and says, please take a look at these 10 makot that you think are 10 makot. And I got news for you. There really are not 10 makot. They're really three programs. It says, Ditzach Adash Be'achav. Ditzach is lesson one. Adash is lesson two. And Ba'ach is lesson three. And then Makat Bechorot. Rabbi Yehuda is not just giving us a mnemonic here. In this particular case, Rabbi Yehuda is actually identifying what's happened. There's one makah, that's makat b'chorot. There are three lessons that leads up to makat b'chorot, and each lesson is made up of three object actions. One with a clear statement of purpose and a warning publicly. One with a private warning, but no reason to repeat the purpose. It's already there. And one is the pop quiz. Kinim is a pop quiz. Shechin is a pop quiz. And Choshech is the power blackout nobody expected. No warning. And so that's what we have when we take a look at the Makot. So to go back to our very original question, why the Makot? Why this whole system? This whole system is there in order to get Paro to publicly state Hashem Elohei HaYivrim Ein Kamohu B'chol HaAretz. There is none like the God of the Hebrews in this land. He controls this land. He's more powerful than all of our Egyptian gods. And therefore, these people who he's claiming are his and not mine. And I can't be their master because the great God claims them as his people. And I have to let them go to serve their God. And that finally happens for a few minutes until Paro changes his mind and runs after us. And that's Kriyat Yam Suf, but we'll leave that for 2 weeks from now. Okay. I promised Rabbi Kelman that we would take it to here and then leave it for any questions in case anybody has any questions. So
I'll take a look at the chat. Do you want there are just a couple questions on the chat box.
Okay, that's fine. Let me take off the share and let's take a look in the chat box. Good. Okay. The Torah, does it use the word makah or makot? Only otot. It uses the word not makah in the sense of a noun, but it uses the word vayach several times, including in the case of dever, specifically in the case of dever, but certainly not for all of them. Right? Good. Otot moftim, by the way, is actually used only in sort of the retrospect and not while they're happening. Okay. Good. So Gershon writes, God declares, I will perform judgments against their God. Right? So what does that mean? So interesting thing. You ask a good question, Gershon. That first of all, the Nile was worshipped by the Egyptians. Was it worshipped as a god? Was it worshipped as a holy thing? Unclear, but it was worshipped by the Egyptians. So to have the first makkah be an attack on the Nile is an example of God doing plagues against their gods. A few decades ago, maybe a century ago, they unearthed an ancient Egyptian temple that had an image of a frog on the front. And evidently that means that something akin to some sort of amphibian thing was also worshipped in Egypt, and very likely that's the story of the frogs. Third thing is we want to get to the cattle, because the cattle sit right in the middle in Dever. The cattle actually play a more critical role in Egypt than we would think. Remember, the second time that we interact with Egypt is when Yosef comes down to Egypt, and Yosef interprets Pharaoh's dreams. Pharaoh's dreams are about the cattle and the stalks. Up until the 15th century BCE, Egypt was essentially two countries. It was Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. And Upper Egypt, which is the Southern Nile, meaning closer to the Sudan, was chiefly a farming area. And Lower Egypt, which is near the Nile, was chiefly a grazing area. And so the pharaohs were buried either with a cattle prod in their hand or with a scythe. And interesting is that from the 15th century BCE on, when the country united into one Egypt, which is why some people think it's called Mitzrayim in the plural, that the pharaohs were then buried with both signs. And so the cattle may also be some sort of a holy thing in their world. And so there is certainly God is attacking the religious symbols of the Egyptians, right? Good. Gershon has an interesting point, that when we think about the Manishtana, and we often refer to it as four questions, you're right, it is one question. Manishtana Laila Zemiko Elot, with either four expansions or four answers, or lots of different ways to interpret it in the same way that we start actually with one plague, but we think of it as many more. Okay, so now Debbie asks, why doesn't it end after the seventh makkah when he admits he's wrong? Because afterwards he turns around and says, no. In other words, at every point when Paro seems to admit defeat, we're ready to say, okay, good, we can leave. And then Paro backs off. Now, by the way, in some of these cases, we have to employ the pasuk in Mishle, Chaf Aleph, pasuk Aleph, Lev Melech B'yad Hashem. Or Paul gave mind believe Melech that God controls the heart of kings, and so that God keeps Paro stubborn. And as he says in the beginning of Parakud, that we'll hear at the beginning of and Mincha this coming Shabbat, that Paro Hashem keeps Paro kind of in the ring so that he can take more punishment. So he will have what to tell his children. We'll have what to tell our children. Okay, and a very nice wish.